Welcome back to The Truth About Vaccines. This is episode number 3. When you were a child, did you have measles or mumps? Did you receive the DPT vaccine? Are you familiar with the concept of being vaccinated for the greater good? All of these topics and many more will be addressed in tonight's episode. I hope you enjoy it. When I was a baby, according to my vaccination records, I received the MMR in 1971, which was the first year that it was available. Now, the MMR vaccine is a vaccine against measles, mumps, and rubella, also known as German measles. It's a mixture of live attenuated viruses of three diseases. Interestingly, I got measles and mumps after I received the MMR vaccine. The MMR was developed by Dr. Morris Hilleman while he was at Merck. He developed over 36 vaccines, which is more than any other scientist in history. He was a member of the U.S. National Academy of Science, the Institute of Medicine, the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and the American Philosophical Society. He received a special Lifetime Achievement Award from the World Health Organization. Hilleman was one of the early vaccine pioneers to warn about the dangers of vaccines. According to the CDC's vaccine excipient summary, here's the ingredients of the MMR vaccine. Sometimes the MMR vaccine is combined with the varicella or chickenpox vaccine, and it's called the MMRV, Proquad. Here are the ingredients of the Proquad. The WI38 cell line was developed by Dr. Leonard Hayflick in 1962 by taking lung cells from an aborted female baby. The MRC5 cell line was developed in 1966 for the Medical Research Council in England. This cell line was cultured from lung tissue taken from another aborted baby. There are actually several vaccines that contain human DNA and aborted fetal tissue, including adenovirus, DTaP, Hep A, Hep B, MMR, MMRV, rabies, varicella, and zoster. I remember having a conversation with my mother when I was in high school. We were discussing vaccines and wondering why I got both measles and mumps, despite the fact that I'd already been vaccinated for both of them.
In many outbreaks of measles, in many outbreaks of pertussis, anywhere from 80 to 90 to 95, and even there's even been outbreaks of the disease where 100% of the cases were in vaccinated populations.
All right, think about it logically, Ty. If vaccines worked,
if they offered immunity, then anytime you saw an outbreak of something among children, you know, measles or mumps or something like that, wouldn't that outbreak happen among only unvaccinated children? That would make logical sense, right? But that's not what we see.
We're seeing disease outbreaks in vaccinated communities. The mumps portion of the MMR vaccine is woefully ineffective. And so we have like the Harvard mumps outbreak, which is exclusively in vaccinated individuals. And so if people know this, then they'll say, why do I need to take a vaccine? Why do I need to take the risk with my wonderful child? Or with myself, or with my aged parents who the nursing home is recommending a flu shot, when they're not effective and they put the individual at risk of all these adverse events.
Dr. Hooker mentioned the Harvard mumps outbreak of 2016, which was actually in a fully vaccinated college population, according to the Public Health Department in Cambridge. In recent years, we've also seen mumps outbreaks in 100% vaccinated populations like the University of Richmond, Loyola University, and Fordham University. Interestingly, in 2010, Merck was sued for selling a vaccine that actually caused mumps and measles outbreaks.
This has even been borne out by the scientists themselves, the virologists who worked for Merck, and they filed the False Claims Act with the federal government, saying that this is all fraud, that the company ordered us to spike these blood samples with antibodies from animals so it would pass the FDA's scrutiny and be accepted as an effective mumps vaccine.
If you look close enough, you'll find all this discrepancy on safety. And that's not even talking about efficacy, because efficacy is another issue, you know? And people say, well, they don't work at all. Well, that's not true. Some of them work, but at what price? So have we reduced measles from the measles shot? We have. breakthrough measles and measles shot spreads measles. I mean, there's all that. There's measles shot failure. We know that. Even if you have antibodies, there are studies from Corpus Christi with an outbreak. But are we better off? I don't think so, because what is the price we're paying?
When Dr. Pilevsky talks about the measles virus, he's talking about a live virus vaccine. And that vaccine, as well as other live viral vaccines, are known to stimulate the Th1 arm of immunity, which is your cell-mediated arm, and which does have a longer lasting, you really only need one or two shots to have long-term, perhaps 20 or 30 years of immunity, if you're one of the, you know, 90% of people who do respond to the vaccine, but between 2 and 10% never respond at all, which is something that is not very talked about very much.
If you look at the work of Suzanne Humphreys, MD, she went into all of the epidemiological literature that exists from government databases and found that if you look at when the main vaccines that we are using still today that are supposed to have saved millions of lives, like for measles, for example, were introduced, it was already at the end of this cycle of mass epidemics because of the introduction of things like refrigeration, municipal cleansed water, good nutrition protocols. These were all the real reasons why these epidemics started to fade away.
Many people who hear what I'm about to say would be very angry at what I'm about to say. They would say that measles is a deadly disease. But it's not. And we create fear because we need to use that fear to get people to get vaccinated. But measles is not a deadly disease. In fact, more than 99% of the time, it's not a deadly disease. In places where there's poverty, malnutrition, poor sanitation, dirty water, starvation, any virus can be a deadly virus because the conditions are what create the opportunity for the symptoms to develop.
What Dr. Pilevsky just described is the law of the terrain, which we discussed in a previous episode. If we look at the graphs of deaths from measles and infections from measles after the measles vaccine was introduced, we can begin to understand the effect that the vaccine had on both of these issues. The first measles vaccine, which was inactivated, was introduced in 1963. We can see clearly from the graph that mortality for the two-decade period before the vaccine was introduced, there was only one or two deaths per year. This is exactly what Dr. Pilevsky just stated. Measles is typically not deadly, especially in light of the society that has improved hygiene, sanitation, clean water, and good nutrition. On the same graph, however, we can also see that infections for measles appeared to decline after the vaccine was introduced, as Dr. Bark just mentioned. In 1963, the year the measles vaccine was introduced, there were around 250 measles infections per 100,000 people. Within 5 years of the vaccine being introduced, the infection rate had dropped to less than 10 per 100,000. But as Dr. Bark also just mentioned, what was the cost? Is it possible that natural exposure to viruses like measles actually might confer a long-term benefit?
I've documented dozens of studies that have come out and have shown that measles, chickenpox, rubella, when you contract these diseases, they've done several studies where they take several hundred or several thousand people that contracted these diseases and they compare them to people that didn't get these diseases. And they show without a doubt that those that have contracted these diseases, they have those diseases have primed and stimulated their immune system to protect them in later life. Those people are less likely to develop all sorts of different types of cancers. And they've also got several studies that I've documented in my books that show that they're protective against cardiovascular disease.
My research into the topic from the National Library of Medicine, you can look at the studies on Greenman Info, shows many health benefits have been identified for infection from things like measles. Some of those include reduction in cancer risk, reduction in cardiac mortality, a reduction in atopic disorders, which are very common, which are autoimmune related to things like dermatitis. So in fact, the theory is that it is essential for our immune system to develop and grow by meeting natural infectious challenges. If you take those away suddenly, what happens is the immune system blows back on itself, and you have what is really, in a way, a submerged iceberg of autoimmune conditions that emerge. Sometimes you call them Th2 dominant disorders, where the adaptive pole of the immune system, it has not been challenged again by normal infections or even germs in the environment, which are really bacteria, which we know now we are comprised primarily of the microbiome is primarily, you know, viruses, fungi, bacteria. So if we don't have infectious agents or germs to be helping us to educate our immune system, then we actually technically start blowing back on ourselves and falling apart. Mm. We need germs. We are germs. In fact, most of our genetic material, 99% of it, is from microbes, viruses, fungi, and bacteria. So how does the CDC and how does conventional immunology and vaccinology explain that fact? They don't, because they haven't caught up with the research. This is only 15 years old, this research.
Sayer G. and Neil Miller are both renowned researchers. And both of them just mentioned health benefits from being exposed naturally to viruses like the measles. The medical literature is replete with studies that confirm this assertion. I recently saw a study at the Mayo Clinic that reiterated the protective benefits that the measles virus has on cancer. It's interesting that the CDC still identifies anyone born before 1957 as having presumptive evidence of immunity against measles due to the lasting protection conferred by natural exposure. As I mentioned previously, I had both measles and mumps, but I didn't have them at the same time.
No person ever experiences two diseases at the same time. So if you're giving the diphtheria, pertussis, tetanus vaccine, you're giving three diseases into the body at the same time. If you're giving a poliovirus vaccine, you're giving three viruses at the same time. If you're giving a Prevnar vaccine, you're giving 13 bacteria injected into the body at the same time. Again, without recognizing whether those organisms already exist in the body and are laying dormant, but also understanding that those diseases never happen at the same time with each other. Back in the late 1900s, early 2000s, when I went to one of the NVIC conferences, there was a presentation given by a doctor named Scott Montgomery, who actually showed that when people had a live measles illness and then soon after had a live mumps illness, when those illnesses happened close together in real life time, there was a greater incidence of inflammatory bowel disease than if people had measles infection live and mumps infection live far apart. So that raises the question, well, if MMR are given together, measles, mumps, and rubella, and parents are talking about children developing gastrointestinal dysfunction consistent with inflammatory bowel changes, then are you increasing the chances of inflammatory bowel disease by administering a vaccine that has two viruses given at the same time? And it's just not even looked at.
I'll just give you one example, and that is the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. Well, first of all, I mean, just as an example, when in Japan they took the mumps vaccine called the Urabi AM9, they gave 5 million doses in Japan and elsewhere as a single vaccine. There were very few, if any, prospectively reported cases of meningitis associated with that vaccine. When they combined it with measles and rubella into the MMR, there was a dramatic increase in the adverse reactions to that vaccine, to mumps. There was a dramatic increase in the rate of meningitis, such that they had to initially try and cover it up to protect the vaccine manufacturers and then withdraw the vaccine altogether. And in Japan, they've never gone back to using MMR because of that scandal. So when you combine three live viruses into one, you have got major problems. Now, the implications of that for safety were completely ignored. But there was a red flag. There was a red flag that should have said, we have got a problem. One and one and one don't equal three, they equal something completely different. So the idea that vaccines are safe is something that's been put out there as a public health, public relations exercise. That's become part of the rhetoric, the mantra. But it's not true at all. And you ask pediatricians, where do you get your information from? Well, we get it from the CDC. Well, the CDC is deeply, deeply compromised. And just in the setting of MMR, we now know from the CDC whistleblower William Thompson that they've been lying about the safety of MMR in the context of autism for 13 or 14 years.
So here you have a doctor who noticed that in a cluster of children who presented with the diagnosis of autism and had inflammatory bowel disease, knowing that there was an increased incidence of inflammatory bowel disease when the measles infection and the mumps infection happened close together, suggested that maybe giving them a measles vaccine and a mumps vaccine close together could add to the same outcome of inflammatory bowel disease in the presence of those two infections happening at the same time. That's all he said. And somehow he became the poster child for vaccines cause autism.
Within 6 months, the health authorities and the governments colluded with the pharmaceutical companies to take away that right. But remember, you have to make an individual measles vaccine, you have to make a mumps vaccine, you have to make a rubella vaccine, and then you combine it all into one vial, okay? But they said, we're not doing it anymore. We're not gonna give parents that option. And so vaccination rates dropped because people wanted the single vaccines. And they blamed it on Andy Wakefield.
Wakefield's data was reproduced. So even though he was discredited, I've heard the man speak, he's brilliant. But as people say, he's nuclear. Don't mention his name or by association, you're guilty of fraud. You know, the guy's brilliant. And he had published tons of articles that are not retracted, you know. And the findings that he found of ileolymphoid dysplasia that he found in the gut of autistic kids who had been vaccinated with the MMR, that's been reproduced. So it's interesting. I had that piece of information, and then I had several patients tell me personally, to my face, my kid was normal, got the MMR, and regressed almost immediately. So in medicine, new information usually comes in the form of what we call a case study. You're going along doing the standard, and then something happens that makes you question what you're doing, and it's a case. So I had multiple cases of parents telling me this had happened. So you have to start going, well, what's going on? Could this be real? Then you find out that our Congress commissioned the CDC to do a study, and it was reported in pediatrics there was no link. Then, in 2005, I read the article written by Brian Hooker, published in Translational Neurodegeneration, not a journal I read daily, but I scan for information about vaccines and autism, and because you have to look for it.
Because, you do this every day.
No? Yeah, every day. I wake up every morning, I look at all the world literature, what's new? That's my routine. And so I saw that article, and I thought, as I read it, it showed data. Whistleblower William Thompson from the CDC, he was actually, and I hadn't known that till I read that article, he was actually the head researcher for that Pediatrics 2004 study that DiStefano had published, and that showed no link between MMR and autism. Well, when he got a hold of the data that had been intentionally excluded, inappropriately so, you don't change study design after the design just because you don't like the results. And this is what they had done. So the actual data showed a 300% increase in autism in African-American boys, and this finding of isolated autism, a huge increase in everyone. And this was like the smoking gun when it comes to the MMR.
I've looked hard at MMR. I was puzzled by it, as I said, because it didn't have the aluminum and didn't have the mercury. But it does have the glutamate, and it has the live virus. It has the live measles, mumps, and rubella viruses. And measles in particular is the one that Andy Wakefield has zeroed in on as being problematic. And the sad thing is that he knew that back in 1998. You know, he published a great paper, and he has follow-on papers that I've read, and they're all terrific. And he was on to so many things about autism way back then, almost two decades ago. And, you know, it is a crime that here's a person who's giving us the answer, and instead of saying, thank you very much, here's your Nobel Prize, you know, they basically tried to destroy his reputation. They took away his license, they retracted the paper. It's incredible to me that the governments don't want to know what's happening to the children.
I think it's interesting to note that back in the 1990s, all that Dr. Andrew Wakefield wanted to do was to investigate whether it would be safer for children to spread out the mumps and the measles vaccines. In his report, he stated that there may be an association between MMR and gastrointestinal disease. His research led him to write a 250-page report concluding that he could not support the use of the combined 3-in-1 MMR vaccine because it simply was not proven to be safe. Did you know that Dr. Andrew Wakefield's research has been replicated in at least 28 different studies in many different countries, including Switzerland?
You mentioned a Swiss study. 180 Swiss physicians analyzed 320 scientific works from around the world. They concluded there is no medical foundation for combining measles, mumps, rubella into one shot.
And of course, this is what Andy Wakefield speaks about. Andy Wakefield says, he said, there might be some evidence that combining the vaccines is more potentially detrimental than not combining the vaccines. That's essentially what he said. He said, Andy Wakefield said, I still recommend vaccination. I just recommend that you break it up. Here's support for what Andy Wakefield said. These are over 300 medical scientists from Europe that signed a petition that said there is no good reason to combine these vaccines. In fact, you have to make them individually.
So it takes extra work to combine it.
Yeah, when Andy Wakefield made that recommendation, within 6 months, they took away that option. The single vaccines were available when Andy Wakefield made that claim.
That was one of the original hypotheses with that 1998 study of the 12 authors in Britain on the potential link between autism and inflammatory bowel disease.
Between MMR.
I'm sorry, MMR and inflammatory bowel disease that had autism as a component.
Right, and all that study did was make a suggestion as to whether giving the measles mumps vaccine together led to an increase in incidence of inflammatory bowel disease, knowing what the live infection close together looked like. And all that study did was suggest that maybe it's more prudent to give the measles vaccine and the mumps vaccine separately.
They had said in the conclusion it deserves further study. They hadn't said that they had proved that MMR vaccine causes autism or inflammatory bowel disease. No. They just simply said that there was an association that they noted.
Right.
But what happened at the press conference was they were asked the question, I think Dr. Wakefield was asked the question, well, what should parents do? And when he said, well, they should ask for separate vaccines, that caused an uproar because, well, first of all, you know, you can't get separate MMR vaccine, measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine anymore. You can't get separate diphtheria pertussis tetanus vaccine anymore. You can get DT, but, you know, now they want to have combination vaccines, and their market for combination vaccines was threatened by the idea that parents could choose to have separate vaccines.
What about MMR? I don't remember, you didn't mention MMR.
So, yes, so for on the vaccine-friendly plan, I made a somewhat arbitrary decision. That one worried me, and I just decided I'm gonna wait till age 3, because I had never seen a child regress into autism after age 3. Now, that was in 2008. I now have over 13,000 patients in my practice. I acquire all the patients in the area who want informed consent, who want to vaccinate differently. I acquire a lot of families who have autism in their family because, you know, they're not getting the kind of care they need. And I have since heard one story of a child, the parents did exactly what I was thinking of doing, which is so wait till age 3, then do the MMR. And so far, in my own population, that's been fine. We haven't had any new autism in over 1,000 patients who followed the vaccine-friendly plan. But I did have one case where the family did that, not at my recommendation, they just came later, got the MMR after age 3, and their kid regressed.
They actually had a family history of autism, so that does put them at a higher risk. If you don't have family history, what I promote, if you're going to vaccinate according to the vaccine-friendly plan, make sure you do not have a family history of autism or severe neurological problems and no autoimmune problems in the family. Those two groups seem to be at highest risk for regression into autism, and perhaps if vaccines are part of the problem, I'm not saying they are, but they sure look like they are.
Another problem is DNA contamination, and that one comes from vaccines that are grown in human tissues or human cells. And so the two that are that fall into that category are rubella vaccine and chickenpox. Now, the thing is that we don't have single vaccines. MMR is one vaccine. And it has measles virus and also DNA contamination from rubella portion of that of the other component. And so DNA is actually an adjuvant in itself. And it induces a type of immune response, which we call Th2, which does not elicit T killer cells. And why is that important? T killer cells are the cells that eliminate virally infected cells. Now, MMR is a live vaccine, so there will be some viral replication and some infection of cells from the vaccine. Now, if you mix DNA into that vaccine, the response that will be elicited will not be the proper one. It will be the one that is mismatched to deal with the live virus. Mm. And that can create a problem that the virus will not be eliminated. And so vaccine virus can stay in the body for much longer than what it intended to be.
Mm. And that's the MMR vaccine?
That's with the MMR vaccine. And that problem would not be in a single measles vaccine because there is no DNA from humans in the single measles vaccine. It is grown in eggs. But when they put so many vaccines together, they carry over this contamination.
So for those that have done their research and they do want to vaccinate their children against mumps and measles, why aren't they given the option to spread out the MMR vaccine? Why are these three vaccines still combined in light of the research that indicates that they would be much safer if they were just spread out? Growing up, one of my favorite TV shows was The Brady Bunch, and I remember an episode where all six kids got measles, but the parents weren't afraid and neither were the doctors. And the kids were actually excited to stay home from school and play Monopoly. Something happened, though, where measles went from being characterized as like a natural rite of passage for strengthening immunity to a deadly infection where our only hope is vaccination and where parents are literally scared to death about the measles.
Measles scares people. We had that big epidemic in Disneyland, a couple hundred cases. You know, the next year there were only a couple hundred cases in the whole country. The whole decade, we've never had more than 700 cases a year. That's not an epidemic. That's just a little cyclical thing that happens. And it's no big deal. But there is no question that our vaccinating with the MMR has reduced measles in the population. So if we went to no vaccines, I think it would be okay. But would we have more measles deaths? Sure we would. And some people can't tolerate that idea because they don't see any negative side to vaccines. But when you see both sides, that there's risks and benefits, then you can start having a real scientific dialogue about what really is best.
The vaccine industry's greatest weapon against medical freedom and medical choice is fear. More than marketing vaccines, the vaccine pushers are marketing fear, and it is irrational fear. If you think about it, the big manipulations of humanity throughout history, it's always through fear. Fear is their weapon, and fear is their way, their method to affect social change through social engineering. So the vaccine industry highlights pandemics, some of which they may have caused themselves because their product doesn't work. It actually spreads disease. But it's that pandemic then, the spreading of measles or mumps, for example, in Disneyland, that creates the fear that leads to the demand by parents for vaccinations and even emboldens the vaccine tyranny pushers who want to force this medical intervention on families and on children who would rather not have that intervention. So they're using fear to take away medical choice. And this medical choice is a fundamental human right. You know, and it's always astonishing to me to find people who say they are politically pro-choice arguing against choice for vaccines. They say, well, a woman's body is her body. No one can tell her what to do with it. which is a position I agree with. And then they say, but let's have the state force all the young children, males and females, to be injected with this toxic vaccine that's going to cause extreme harm among some percentage of those children. Well, that's a violation of the very tenet of medical choice and medical freedom, and it should not exist in a free society.
According to information from the study presented by California Healthline, 86% of those who caught measles at Disneyland during the outbreak of 2014 were fully up to date on their MMR. Media reports blame the unvaccinated for the outbreak despite the 86% vaccination rate. It's important to note that the Disneyland measles outbreak of 2014 was used to push through the approval of Senate Bill 277, which requires that all school children in California be vaccinated and removed all exemptions to vaccinations. Have you ever heard of the concept of shedding? That's what happens when you give a live virus vaccine to someone and the virus can infect other people who come into contact with the person who got the vaccine. Shedding has been proven to occur up to 37 days after someone is vaccinated. Is it possible that this is the reason that we've seen more cases of measles over the past few years?
Now, measles is on the rise again, but that's not from the original measles virus. That's from the attenuated version from the vaccine. So now we have a brand new disease in the human species, measles, that is from the vaccine itself. So did you have measles as a child?
I did.
I did too. So we got lifetime immunity from having measles. Now, but the problem is, Ty, we may not be immune to this new atypical version of measles that is coming out now that is caused by 90% of American children being vaccinated with MMR vaccine since 1978 in this country.
What about rubella? That's the R in the MMR vaccine. Here's Dr. Tatiana Ubakanic and Dr. Sean Sinners discussing this topic.
Some parents might decide that it's really worth for them to do the measles vaccine and not so much the rubella vaccine. But if you have everything in three, then you're pretty much forced to do the rubella as well.
Right. Yeah, because I mean, I don't know the last time I heard about rubella here in this country being an outbreak of rubella.
Well, usually rubella is dangerous when it happens during pregnancy. So it's important that women, or in the past that women would get immune from rubella by going through rubella during their childhood, so that by the time they are mothers, they don't have to deal with rubella infections. They wouldn't have any risk for it. So in a way, rubella parties would be great to get everyone immune to this really mild disease.
Right.
But again, instead of doing that, instead of doing this self-empowering kind of method of getting over with rubella, instead it was decided to eliminate it. And for that, you need to vaccinate both females and males. Wow. And males have absolutely no benefit from rubella vaccination for themselves, since there are really no risks from that.
Wow. So the males, rubella vaccine is useless.
Well, it's not beneficial because the only time when rubella is dangerous, as I said, it's during pregnancy.
Well, you know, that has to do with marketing, right? So wouldn't it, you'd make more money if you're selling three vaccines in one than just two vaccines, right? So that's marketing and money and things like that. It's not medicine.
There are literally hundreds of articles from peer-reviewed medical literature that document some of the other chronic adverse conditions from the MMR vaccine, including neurological disorders, serious blood disorders, sensory impairments including eye disorders and hearing loss, immune system damage, bowel disease, severe allergic reaction, and atypical measles from the MMR vaccine. Here are a couple snippets from interviews with people whose lives have been directly affected by the MMR vaccine.
Talk about your son. Because right. I think that's probably one of the main reasons that you're involved in this.
Completely. So the main reason I work with Andy Wakefield, the main reason I'm here now, right, is because what happened to my son was so awful, so tragic. And I was so pro-vaccine, I was so follow the system. It's a very British upbringing of, you know, you do as you're told at all times. And so I didn't question, and my older daughter had all her vaccines. I didn't question it, didn't think to even think what's in it. I just assumed that this doctor had my son's wellness and best interest at heart. And so in the morning he had the vaccine. By the evening he was having the most horrific seizure.
Really?
Yeah. And the week after that, and they said, the most important thing here is they said to us in hospital, he's had the MMR. We didn't say it was the MMR. They said, once he had that day, we said he's had a vaccine in the morning. Oh, that'll be what it is. We see this. It's going to be okay. It's just a common reaction to this vaccine. Give him some antibiotics. Let him sleep it off. He'll be good. No, he did sleep. He slept and slept and slept. And to a degree, he's still sleeping now because he's not the kid that he should have been at 13 months when he had it. He's very, very sick. He's damaged. He's damaged badly. He's going to need care for the rest of his life. Mm. So it's no joke, this vaccine injury. You know, people, they just don't understand that when they take that needle and they put it in their child, we do not know if your child is going to be okay or whether it's going to be like Billy. We don't know why this is happening. We can guess, we don't know why, but it is happening. So my advice to parents right now is until they work it out, you got to stay away.
Mm. How old is Billy now?
He's 20 and, he's big, he's huge. You know, you can see him in Vax. He's hard worker, he's beautiful, I love him to bits, but he can get aggressive and it's frightening. Mm. And he doesn't mean to, he just doesn't understand. This is the result of a vaccine injury. This is what happens.
I got a vaccine injury, so now I can't walk long distances or play running sports or even go to the playground and play with other kids.
Because?
Because my legs get too tired and my muscles get too tired to have sustained endurance. One of the harder parts is because I go to an online public school, the students don't see each other unless on field trips. So in GT Lit, I was talking to my friend Remy, but we never met in person. But we finally went to a field trip, and Remy's like, I didn't know you were in a wheelchair.
It's the first thing that mm-hmm. people notice and yeah. people react to.
What does that feel like when they said that?
Kind of excluded.
What yes. would you say to a mummy who's about to give her baby the vaccines?
Don't. Don't because and explain the facts that by 2025 there'll be a 1 in 2 chance of autism in your child, and explain the facts and the statistics and the ingredients in vaccines so they don't end up like I did and they don't make the same mistakes and pharma doesn't get money for injuring kids.
Those are some profound words from a beautiful young lady. During our interview where Lene shared with me personal details about her vaccine injury, I was really touched and inspired. There's no doubt that vaccines can injure. That's why we have the Vaccine Injury Compensation Fund. The question is whether or not the risks outweigh the benefits. That's a personal decision for each and every one of us. I remember about a decade ago, I had a discussion with a pediatrician about whooping cough, also known as pertussis. We were discussing whether the risks of the vaccine outweighed the benefits. He clearly believed that there were very few risks and enormous benefits from that vaccine. There are several current vaccines for pertussis, depending upon the manufacturer, but they're generically referred to as the DTaP, which stands for diphtheria, tetanus, and acellular pertussis. And this vaccine is given to children. The Tdap, which is combined tetanus, diphtheria, and pertussis, is generally given to adolescents and adults. On the screen are the ingredients for the three most common DTaP vaccines. In the early 1990s, these vaccines replaced the whole cell pertussis vaccine, which was called the DPT. Let's look a little closer at these diseases and the vaccines. The first clip is from Erin Elizabeth, who as a child was vaccinated and she was injured by the DPT vaccine.
Back in 71, they took me in for my DPT, and we think that's the main shot that I had at that time. And within hours, I began seizing. My fever was 104, which lasted a week. So, and what the doctors were thinking was they were worried about encephalitis, but looking back, we probably think that I did have encephalitis. And I was brought into the hospital and they had to restrain me. There's different, I'm never sure if I've heard straitjacket or restraints or different. different measures that they used in order to do that spinal tap, because they were checking for spinal meningitis. That was the initial thought, because of course at the beginning they don't want to connect it with the vaccines I just had hours ago. You know, it must be spinal meningitis.
So they look every other place.
Yeah,
other than
I know.
The obvious.
Right? Yes. But even eventually the pediatrician then would check for my neck, because he said, I think she might, you know, have that rare bad reaction, and it looks like I did. And I was really fortunate. After a week, I believe they even were bringing the priest in, because the fever didn't break and they were concerned. I was vomiting along with the seizing, and when you go a week that long with that high of a fever, I don't think that can be beneficial for the brain. It's got to be real,
real
detrimental. And so after a week, it was really kind of like another miracle, like the just a few months before, where the fever, I was vomiting, seizing, hospitalized. They did the spinal tap. It was normal. But then suddenly the fever broke and the vomiting stopped. And it was just, I was really one of the lucky ones.
You're a miracle baby.
Yeah. That's what they said back then.
Well, I was a first time mom, little boy, in 1980 when I took him in for a fourth DPT shot. And back then parents hadn't been told anything about vaccines, the fact that they could cause reactions, injuries, deaths. So when he actually had DPT and oral polio vaccine that day, and within hours of that fourth DPT shot in 1980 at age 2.5, I witnessed reactions, and I didn't know they were reactions. He had a convulsion, a collapse shock, and a brain inflammation. But because I'd been told nothing by my pediatrician about how to recognize vaccine reactions, I didn't understand what I was witnessing. I now know he could have died in his bed that night. I know that if I hadn't awakened him, my mother was a nurse, in the middle of this reaction, which I didn't understand was a reaction, I think he would have been catastrophically brain injured. What happened after that shot was he regressed physically, mentally, and emotionally, and became a totally different child. He no longer could recognize the alphabet, which he had known. He couldn't recite numbers up to 20. He became emotionally fragile, could not concentrate for more than a few seconds at a time. He became very angry at the slightest frustration. It was like I had a different child, and I didn't understand what had happened to him. My family didn't understand. He had constant diarrhea, respiratory infections, ear infections, until in the spring of 1982, about 18 months later, I saw the documentary DPT Vaccine Roulette. It was produced out of the MBSC affiliate here. Lee Thompson was the producer. And that documentary was the first time that American parents had been told that vaccines can brain injure children. And so I asked for copies of the studies that NBC affiliate WRC had used to produce DPT Vaccine Roulette, and they gave them me copies. I went home, and I'll never forget sitting in my living room and reading the New England Journal of Medicine, Pediatrics, the British Medical Journal, these studies, and the descriptions of DPT vaccine reactions that completely matched the symptoms that I had seen my son suffer that day. And I thought, here we have doctors talking in medical journals about how DPT vaccine can brain injure children. And they haven't told the parents. They never told the mothers like me. After looking at those studies, that I realized what had happened to my son, I decided to research pertussis and pertussis vaccine. About 8 months into the research, I got a phone call from Harris Coulter, medical historian, and he and I had a conversation. At the end of the conversation, I said, Harris, would you like to co-author a book with me? And he said, sure. And we spent 2.5 years researching for what would be the book, DPT, A Shot in the Dark, published in 1985 by Harkup Race Ivanovich. And it was really the first book that documented what was wrong, what is wrong with the mandatory vaccination system in this country.
In the early 1980s, starting actually 79 or so, there was a paper that was released that showed a pretty high incidence of seizures and these hypotonic collapses. Along with the lawyers finding out, a number of parents started to look at their kid and say that that's exactly what happened to my child. And, you know, they would call their doctors, and the doctors, the medical establishment has a history that I'm sure that other people in your film will talk about, but the medical establishment has a history of trying to deny and bury certain things when it doesn't fit their needs at the time. So many doctors were minimizing, underplaying, downplaying. Your child is colicky, don't worry about it. You know, it's a stage of development. And the next thing that parents do when they can't get satisfaction from the medical profession is they contact the legal profession. Once the litigation began, I told you, you know, in the very beginning that there was a historical time when the truth was being told. Then it became more in the interest of the industry to not only downplay, but to misdirect and to change the numbers and to change the knowledge and change the database that they were working from, because it was condemning them. They it was making them look very bad. So they got into this phase where they started to pay for studies and they started to sponsor studies. And there was a major study done at UCLA. In that study, it began as a 50,000 dose study. During the study, somebody went from one of the drug companies out to UCLA to just kind of poke around and talk to the doctors that were doing the study and see what they're coming up with and, you know, how's it going? Is there anything we can do for you as a drug company to help this study along? And at that point, they had given about, if I remember right, I think it was 1,500 shots. So there were 1,500 shots into a 50,000 shot study. The doctor that went out there came back to his company and told them, we're in trouble, because out of the 1,500 shots, there have been 5 seizures out of 1,500, and they expected to see 1 in 15,000. During that study, After the company showed up on the scene at UCLA, somehow or other the numbers changed. They went from having a real lot of them to all of a sudden not having so many after the guy visited. So in one of my lawsuits, when I took the deposition of the director of the vaccine program for this particular drug company, he admitted to me that he could have gone to the warehouse and said, send that lot to UCLA, don't send that lot. And the lots all varied. There was a huge variation between the potency of the lots. So by sending a less potent lot, they were going to get way less reactions, severe reactions. It's just simple mathematics. So I basically charged that they had manipulated the scientific data, that the study was invalid. So now there's this whole issue of the truth coming out about the fact that they're now starting to lie, because they went from being truthful because they didn't think they had anything to worry about to getting sued, manipulating the data to make it more difficult for us to sue. Then we got into a situation where, now at this point we're talking about probably 1985 or so, early 86, but right around 85. And what happened was that a judge in New Jersey ordered one of the companies to produce their documents too fast for them to be able to be careful and sanitize them. So along with the 80 boxes of documents that were delivered to my office, there were some documents that we probably never should have seen as lawyers. Had their lawyers done their homework, they wouldn't have included them. They would have said that they were privileged, and they would have put up a fight. But the judge made them go so fast because they were refusing to produce, so he basically said, okay, fine, you have 48 hours to get the 80 boxes to Boston from New Jersey. So they started packing up trucks, and they shipped up the boxes to us. And I found documents in there that showed really an intent on their part to deceive the medical establishment, to deceive the FDA, and to deceive the doctors, and to deceive the parents. There were several different types of documents. One dealt with pricing. We're getting sued. We can't afford the lawsuits. What do we do to make it so that the product stays profitable? And so before that study was done, it was a basic break-even analysis that was done. And before that was done, vaccines cost 28 cents a shot. It was $2.80 to buy a vial of the stuff that had 10 shots in each vial. After that study, and literally overnight, they went from $2.80 to $174.50 a vial. And what they determined was that a dead baby is worth $500,000 in a lawsuit, and a living baby with brain damage, and this is back in 80, we're talking 80, maybe 83 or so. This is right off in the very beginning of the vaccine. And so they were figuring $1 million a case for brain damaged babies. And so using those assumptions, at so many lawsuits per million doses given, how much is it going to cost? And I'll show later, I'll show the graph that's actually one of my slides that they actually graphed it out and drew circles. This is where we have to be, and it came out to 174.
What do you think about the fact that pharmaceutical companies know that a vaccine will cause X percent of babies to die, and then they put an actuarial price on that baby's head in determining the cost of the vaccine?
Well, in 1978-79, there were 11 babies who died within a week of receiving DPT shots. The majority of them had received vaccine from a single lot, a single manufacturer. When the health authorities looked into it, the state health authorities, they realized that statistically, the probability of that cluster occurring by chance alone was very low. The CDC got involved and they held a meeting, and they didn't want to alarm the public. So they didn't withdraw the lot.
They determined that those deaths were caused by one single lot of DPT vaccine, that all the kids happened to get the same lot number from different doctors, but it was all distributed to Tennessee. And so the company, instead of acting responsibly on that, first of all, denied any lawsuits. They weren't going to pay any settlements on it. They made all of these people sue. Second of all, they decided that instead of sending a bunch of one lot to one distribution center in one state, they would send small bits from lots of different lots to that same distribution center in one state. So therefore, instead of getting 5,000 packages of this stuff delivered to Chicago for the Illinois area, they would only get maybe a couple of hundred of this lot and a couple of hundred of that lot. And that way they're sending it all over the country. And so if they have a hot lot that causes deaths, like the Tennessee cluster was, it would be all over the country and nobody would pick up on it. Nobody would say, it was their vaccine that caused it, because it's all over the place, and the doctor from Florida might never know about a doctor in Anchorage, Alaska that lost a patient. And so that was their idea of how to proceed with professionalism.
What exactly, Barbara, is a hot lot?
A hot lot of vaccine is a vaccine. It was usually associated with DPT vaccine. They don't like to talk about hot lots, where an unusual number of children who received the vaccine from a single lot would have seizures, deaths, any serious adverse event. And so they're now no longer distributing lots into a specific part of the country so that there can't be an association seen.
So what makes the lots differ to where some might be more deadly than others?
So it depends how vaccine is purified. So originally, they grow bacteria and then they purify components from that bacteria. But endotoxin is very sticky and it could still stick to those components. And so it would really depend on batch per batch basis. Okay. It's unpredictable.
So you never know.
You never know, and every single lot needs to be tested for endotoxin to really know what's going on. And if it exceeds certain level, it has to be discarded. I think that's what's going on in Japan. They really bring it down. But there are no regulations in the United States.
According to Dr. Tatyana Ubakanich, there are no regulations in the United States regarding the amount of endotoxins that can be included in vaccines, which can give rise to batches of hot lot vaccines. Before the early 1990s, we used a different kind of pertussis vaccine, a whole cell vaccine called the DPT. It was more potent, but there were serious side effects like 11 deaths, which we just heard about in the Tennessee hot lot that Barbara Lowe Fisher and attorney Michael Hugo just described.
So DTP is whole cell pertussis. Okay. It includes whole cell pertussis component. Whereas DTaP, there is a little A in there. It stands for a cellular pertussis. Yeah. So instead of including the whole pertussis bacterium in there, they isolate certain proteins from the surface of the bacterium as well as pertussis toxin, and that becomes the vaccine.
Okay. So the DTaP is the new one?
The DTaP is relatively new one. It was developed in Japan in the 80s when it was noticed that DTaP, the old one, is giving problems. It's reactogenic and sometimes results in death. And in Japan, interestingly, only after two cases of death were reported after DTaP, it was pulled. And then Japanese researchers developed DTaP.
Okay, so there literally have been people that have been killed by the DPT vaccine.
Right, obviously.
The worst part for the manufacturers would have been the fact that we discovered that in Japan, they don't have these injuries. They don't have the seizure disorders and the hypotonic collapses that I described earlier. And they don't have the same vaccine that we have in this country. So we did a patent search. We found out that one of the current vaccine manufacturers at that time had a patent going back to 1937. And they've had the technology for that long to make it safer. And that's the you heard me mention DPT earlier, but today the vaccine is DTaP. It's diphtheria and it's tetanus, but the pertussis component is acellular, which means it's an interrupted cell. It's not the whole bacteria that's being thrown into the kid, and it's much more pure. It still has reactions, but it's way more pure. So the juries would have heard that the manufacturers had the technology and the capability to prevent this child's injury since 1937, but didn't do it. Then I started out on a campaign to figure out why wouldn't they do it? And the only answer I could get from the vaccine industry was that it cost a half a cent a dose more to make the safer vaccine. So now you have all of the documents that we've discussed. You have the break-even point with the new prices. You have the Tennessee SIDS cluster. You have all of those documents we've talked about. And then we have a document saying we could have done better, but it cost a half a cent a dose more. So what I did was I actually had a half a cent. I had somebody machine down a penny, so it was one half size. And I carried that everywhere with me. And when I would go into a courtroom, it would go on the jury rail, or it would go on my desk in front of my papers. And way into the case, somewhere along the line, somebody would testify to the half a cent, and I'd hold up the half a cent. And then the jury would understand why I had the half a cent there. When you stand behind a child in a wheelchair who's looking up at the ceiling with drool coming down the side of his face and his arms clenched sideways like this, and he's just looking up in the air, and that's all he's done for a month-long trial, and you hold a half a cent up behind that child and say, this would have prevented this. There's no coming back from that for the manufacturers.
In 1986, we had the landmark case, Graham versus Wyeth, which awarded the plaintiff $15 million for permanent neurological damage sustained from the DPT vaccine. The jury found that the drug company, Wyeth, knew or should have known that the DPT vaccine caused neurological damage in children, making their product unsafe. Because of all this, we changed the vaccine to the acellular kind, which has fewer side effects. We went from the DPT to the DTaP and the TDAP.
If you have the little A in there, that's acellular pertussis. So the A before the P is acellular pertussis. And since about early 90s, we changed in the US from the DPT without the A. So that was the diphtheria tetanus pertussis. That was called the whole cell.
So now it used to be DPT, now it's TDAP.
Yeah.
And then the A before the P is acellular pertussis.
There's DTAP and TDAP. The TDAP is the 7 and above, 7-year-olds and
okay,
above.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
There's just a little age difference, okay. slight difference. Let me give you the informed consent talk about the pertussis. So whether or not you got it while you were pregnant, which if it was my wife, I wouldn't. I just don't, there are no safety studies of injecting aluminum into pregnant moms. So But whether or not you got it during pregnancy, we have a handful of deaths a year in the United States from pertussis, whooping cough. And any death, if it's your baby, that's bad, right? So the way pediatricians think and infectious disease experts, and a lot of times it's the infectious disease experts who end up at the CDC and make all these recommendations, and I mean, they are the most well-read on infectious disease, right? And they also see the worst case scenario. So if you talk to any pediatrician or infectious disease person, we've probably treated or known about a child who was on a respirator fighting for their lives for whooping cough. And so that's why you'll hear pediatricians are just, you know, adamant, you've got to do this vaccine. And it might, probably would, reduce your risk to getting whooping cough. The current Tdap that we have, the acellular pertussis vaccine, is not very effective. In fact, it's so ineffective that the CDC now recommends for pregnancy you get it every pregnancy. So if you just had a baby and you've just delivered and you get pregnant again, it's only been a year, they're going to want you to do it again. Why? Well, it's not giving very good protection. So if we give you another one, maybe it'll give you some protection for that baby. So how many deaths are there a year in the United States from whooping cough?
You want me to take a guess?
Do you know?
Less than 10.
You're right. It's usually 5 to 10. Okay. So most people would probably think millions because of all the fear, right? There's 5 to 10 deaths. Most of them are in infants. In fact, most of them are 3 months and under. So if you're going to get any protection, maybe you should give it during pregnancy. That's their rationale, right? Because those few deaths are happening in the first few months of life. That's the rationale, but they're not looking at the toxin side. So if you're giving informed consent, people need to know, do I want to poison my baby? Guaranteed poisoning for the possible chance I'm going to... How many births do we have in the U.S. per year?
4 million?
Perfect. 4 million. So we have about 4 million births, and let's just say we have 4 or 5 deaths per year. So it's a 1 in a million risk of you losing your baby to pertussis.
Literally 1 in a million.
It's literally 1 in a million. If it's my baby, I'm willing to take that risk. If, in other words, not do that vaccine and take that 1 in a million chance. Much more likely to be struck by lightning probably twice or in the same spot, I don't know. That's not to underestimate the tragedy for that person who loses their baby. But if you're doing scientific research, you need to look at data, right? So you've got a guaranteed risk of toxicity because you're injecting aluminum to a very small body.
Children under 3 months of age are at higher risk of contracting pertussis and having it be a serious illness because their windpipe is so small and they really can't cough, and that can be a real problem. But the older that people get, the less likely they are to contract with anything serious. I mean, what is pertussis? It's a cough that's persistent, that doesn't have a fever, and is worse at night, and can go on for an extended period of time. It can happen in any age group. And now that we know for sure, I mean, the CDC even says the pertussis vaccines really don't work much anymore. We don't really know why. We don't know if the bacteria has morphed or changed. We know we're seeing more of a bacterial infection called parapertussis, which the vaccine doesn't do anything for that. And so, and when they have these outbreaks of pertussis that they're diagnosed, and then they retrospectively do the analysis, they find out that 80 some percent or more of the people who contract pertussis have been fully vaccinated. And so the numbers of unvaccinated are extraordinarily small, but of course, they're the ones that we blame for all of these outbreaks.
You and I are being told that it's the unvaccinated children that are causing the spread of pertussis, and that everyone needs to be vaccinated to protect those that can't be vaccinated against pertussis, okay? Like the immune compromised, okay? But the reality is that there's at least 3 dozen studies, and I document these and summarize these studies in my books, okay? That confirm that the pertussis vaccine actually caused evolutionary adaptation of the Bordetella pertussis microorganism, okay? So that it has adapted and evolved so that the strains that were targeted are no longer the strains that are causing the disease. They've become new strains, and the vaccine is no longer effective against the new strains. studies have just come out that confirm that people that are vaccinated against measles can spread the disease. They are carriers of the disease, and they can spread it to other people, and they are. And this is the same thing that's happening with the pertussis vaccine. They have now documented that people that are vaccinated against pertussis are silent carriers of pertussis. The disease is developing inside their throats. Now, the person that got vaccinated may not develop the disease, but they are infectious. And like Typhoid Mary from years ago, who did not exhibit symptoms of typhoid, but Typhoid Mary was able to spread typhoid to other people. She was contagious. The people that are vaccinated against pertussis are like Typhoid Mary. I call them Whooping Wally and Pertussis Peggy. They are silent carriers of pertussis, and they are capable of spreading pertussis to other people. This is documented in the studies.
They did really good job in making this vaccine safer than the old one in Japan. And they do it by monitoring endotoxin levels in vaccines very strictly. So they have certain requirements that endotoxin level in vaccines have to be under certain limit. In the United States, however, these limits are applied only to drugs and not to vaccines. So in terms of vaccines, we have absolutely no idea what's going on in American vaccines or European vaccines with the levels of endotoxin. And what is endotoxin? So endotoxin comes from a bacteria, from certain types of bacteria called gram-negative bacteria. Pertussis is one of the gram-negative bacteria. So naturally, pertussis has endotoxin on its surface. Now, the problem is that endotoxin is very reactogenic, and that's what was hypothesized was the problem with the old whole cell vaccine. So it is imperative to remove that as much as possible from the new vaccine. However, recent as 2012, Japanese researchers did investigation and comparison of vaccines that are produced in Japan using their own very stringent standards and vaccines that are produced abroad and imported to Japan. And they found that the cellular pertussis vaccines that are produced abroad have as much endotoxin as the old whole cell vaccine.
Back in the 1980s, they had a whole cell pertussis vaccine, and they realized that that vaccine was very reactive and was causing a high incidence of neurological damage. And back in the mid to late 1990s, they switched over to what they called an acellular pertussis vaccine. Okay, they believed that it was less reactive. It was causing less adverse reactions, but the trade-off was it might not be as effective. And in fact, they know that for a fact that that vaccine is not very effective because they're giving at least 5 doses of the pertussis vaccine to everybody, right, to children. Children are receiving 5 doses, but they've got studies that show within 12 to 24 months, those children might have already lost anywhere from 50 to 75 or 80% of their protection from that vaccine already. So the vaccine has very poor efficacy, and the documentation is showing that many children are still being damaged from the pertussis vaccine.
What Neil Miller just said about people being silent carriers is supported by a November 25th, 2013 article in the Washington Post, which quotes FDA researcher Todd Merkel. He says the research suggests that while the vaccine may keep people from getting sick, it doesn't prevent them from spreading whooping cough, also known as pertussis, to others. It could explain the increase in pertussis that we're seeing in the United States. In other words, the vaccines may keep you from showing any symptoms while you spread pertussis to everyone else. It's interesting that the Sanofi Pasteur version of the DTaP vaccine, Tripedia, listed SIDS, autism, and anaphylactic shock as possible adverse events. But this vaccine was pulled from the market in 2011 due to these adverse events. Regarding tetanus, in the 1990s, there was a tetanus toxoid vaccine that was laced with HCG and caused spontaneous abortions in the pregnant women to whom it was given.
I have all those papers, and what really surprised me the most is that that research was not, done covertly. It was very put out in the open. This one Indian researcher was talking about how, we needed better birth control in these highly overpopulated, that's what they consider them, overpopulated areas, and that it was supposed to be a temporary effect, and according to them it is. And so basically it has HCG, so the mother mounts an antibody response, so she's not going to, be able to be pregnant because that hormone's necessary. But they were giving, these vaccines far more frequently than they needed to prevent tetanus. And so this, it's not actually covert research. It was very much out in the open. I have all the papers. And for people to have gotten to a point where they felt that that was okay, I think that's really what surprised me the most, that this was considered an ethical thing. And they actually considered it to be, a gift to these populations, that they wanted to help them control their numbers.
They were targeting young girls of childbearing age and giving them boosters every few months. They were receiving like 5 doses of tetanus shots, which made no sense. So that alerted people, and then every batch that had been tested had HCG in it.
And it was causing them to have spontaneous abortions.
Absolutely. Because if you create antibodies to HCG, every time you're pregnant, you will miscarry. Right.
Using the tetanus toxoid as a form of surreptitious birth control is problematic from an ethical and moral perspective. But the Philippines isn't the only place where women have been given a vaccine that caused abortions and even sterility.
I think they are using Africans as guinea pigs to try and make their products. That's their drugs. Sometimes they come and do their things here, like those vaccines. They want to try and monitor after this years how this vaccine will work. I think it's very, very bad because these vaccines are given to very young children, and like 14 years, and that's very, let's say, the reproductive age. And that's not good. I don't think why this vaccine should be given to women at that age. Imagine now that someone has grown up and you are not able to give birth. And that's very wrong. That's so inhuman. It upsets me very, very much, very, very much, very, very much.
Using vaccines in this manner may be troubling and upsetting to you, like it is to me, but it follows the utilitarian philosophy, or what's best for the greater good. This philosophy was used in a Supreme Court case over 100 years ago.
In 1905, the Supreme Court in Jacobson versus Massachusetts said that the states have the constitutional authority to use police powers to mandate smallpox vaccine. That was what that decision was about, smallpox vaccination. That was a very utilitarian decision because the man, Jacobson, who was actually, I think he was a Lutheran pastor, had objected to the law because he said that he believed that there was genetic predisposition way back then for his son and him, because they both had severe reactions to previous smallpox vaccinations. In a very utilitarian decision, and again, utilitarianism was not the principle upon which the United States of America was founded. This country was founded on very different principles. Utilitarianism means the greatest happiness for the greatest number of people. And when you use utilitarianism to basically buttress public health policy, you can create what is known as the tyranny of the majority, where minorities and individuals who are susceptible, for example, to vaccination for biological and genetic and other reasons are basically considered expendable, sacrificed for the happiness of the rest.
So he was ordered to pay a $5 fee in lieu of receiving the smallpox vaccine. Now, right there, that was the start. That is what many of the court cases today will go back and cite, the 1905 Jacobson versus Massachusetts decision, a $5 fee for an adult to avoid one vaccine. Now, that decision was erroneous, and I can't believe it hasn't been overturned, because there should be no forced medicine. But the 1947 Nuremberg Code should most certainly have nullified and made void the 1905 decision. And we've had subsequent treaties that we've signed. The 2005 UNESCO agreement, again, upholds the right of prior voluntary and informed consent prior to any medical intervention, and that includes vaccinations.
Interesting thing about Jacobson versus Massachusetts. It paved the way for a decision in 1927, Buck versus Bell. Oliver Wendell Holmes was a Supreme Court justice that articulated the majority position in Buck versus Bell, 1927. And what that decision was is Buck versus Bell basically said it was okay for the U.S. states to pass eugenics laws. Carrie Buck, they said, was mentally retarded, just like her mother and her child. She was an unmarried mother in Virginia. They incorrectly judged her to be mentally retarded, and also that her child was mentally retarded. And Holmes said, three generations of imbeciles are enough. The principle that sustains compulsory vaccination is broad enough to cover the cutting of the fallopian tubes. That decision gave the green light to Virginia and other states to pass eugenics laws that forcibly sterilized over 60,000 Americans between 1927 and the mid-1940s, when finally they abandoned the sterilization, the routine sterilization of people that they thought were genetically defective or in some way a threat to the health of the state. When you adopt a utilitarian rationale to forward public policy and vaccine mandates, it's a very slippery slope. And who's to say one child is expendable for another?
There's right. definitely a philosophy that it's okay to sacrifice the health of a few in order for the good of many. And so when you see politicians, medical doctors, parents, governmental officials saying vaccines are safe, they've been properly tested, they are effective, anybody who runs with those statements has only read the title of the article. They've not gone further than the title.
Once you say as a society that individual human life doesn't matter, that minorities who are susceptible to having reactions or being injured by a pharmaceutical product like a vaccine, then where does it end? How many are too many to sacrifice? Is it 500, 5,000, 5 million? How many is too many to sacrifice in the name of the greater good?
How many is too many to sacrifice? And while we're on the topic of potential targeting of minority populations, I asked Dr. Larry Pilevsky about the recent outbreaks of Zika virus and the microcephaly, which is when the baby's head is too small, which is attributed to this virus.
Many theories have been put forth, and I don't know which one is true, if any of them are true. One of them is that that section was sprayed with an excess amount of pesticides, including Roundup glyphosate. Another one is that those pregnant mothers were given a DPT vaccine and or an MMR vaccine. Both vaccines in the literature are known to contribute to the incidence of microcephaly. We don't see the incidence of microcephaly where there's also a large increase in Zika virus infections. As far as I know, based on the literature, the Zika virus illness is benign. In New York, in the month of August, because of the threat of Zika virus, they sprayed different communities. And when I read the list of all the communities, it was all the communities where minorities live. It wasn't the white, wealthy areas of New York City or Long Island. It was all areas where there are known to be minority populations. Now, I don't know any conclusions from that, other than to say, why?
Research published in the National Center for Biotechnology Information reveals that the U.S. government knew as early as 1991 that the Tdap vaccine causes microcephaly. I think the real issue here is the freedom to choose. It's about fundamental rights. It's about making choices that keep our children safe.
I actually was a vaccine-injured child. 6 months of age, I was a severe bronchial asthmatic, and I recall that that seemed to have been very formative in who I am today and why I'm so into educating people about a better way. So for me, I have two daughters, and when that happened, something shifted in me, because it's clear to me that in this world they now live in, it is very likely at some point, especially depending on what state they live in, that they will be told that they have to inject something into their body. Now, as I understand it, the moment the state wields that sort of power over our bodies, that redefines us as chattel or property, because that means that we don't even have the basic right to bodily self-possession. So without the choice to basically involve ourselves, we are essentially identifying ourselves as slaves or objects. And that is something that I think many, especially mothers and parents, you know, who have children who are being faced with the question, should I vaccinate according to the schedule? Can I trust my pediatrician who is telling me we have to do this? They don't fully understand that the moral, you know, right is behind them. They have as parents the right and even the responsibility to choose what's best for their children, no matter what the state states is their power over them. You can't really think of any other example of a compulsory medical intervention beyond maybe water fluoridation, where there's absolutely no attempt at informed consent, putting a pharmaceutical product in your water. But with vaccination, they're making it now appear that if you do not comply with the ever-expanding schedule, because there's over 271 vaccines in the pipeline right now, I mean, it is a feeding frenzy as far as the opportunity to profit from the pharmaceutical perspective. But if you don't comply fully, they make it seem as if you're doing violence not just to your own child, but to children around you. And of course, any common sense approach would acknowledge that if the vaccines work, why are you so afraid of my child not getting them, right? That is a subconscious acknowledgement that they don't even believe they work. Yeah. So why would you vaccinate your child if you're afraid that the non-vaccinated would infect your child? Because aren't they supposed to confer superpowers? So it's an absurdity. And of course, as you know, the live vaccines, like MMR, actually cause infection in those individuals that can shed and then transfer viral particles to those who are not vaccinated. So it's actually the opposite. Instead of, quite frankly, what's going on, it's like saying your child who's not vaccinated needs to put a yellow star on their lapel, and that if they don't comply, you know, they're doing harm and attacking other children with their non-vaccination status. It's really disturbing.
I talked to a woman from the Soviet Union, and she cautioned me to be careful with this word, civil disobedience, because she said when she was there for the fall of the Soviet Union, many people in the Soviet Union knew that the government was corrupt, knew it was going to fall, but no one knew when. So they had people standing up, and the next day, those people were gone to the camps. And who replaced them were people that would toe the party line. So she warned, and I also want to get this out every time I speak about this, doctors and nurses understand that if you stand up, there's a possibility that you're going to lose your job and livelihood, and perhaps even more. And what's going to be replacing that is someone that's going to toe the line of the system and force vaccines when these mandates come through and these laws come through. So when I say civil disobedience and medical disobedience, I'm saying we work within the system to internally continue to sabotage this until the time is right and there's critical mass. And with the open sourcing of information journalism, this critical mass is coming very quickly. So I don't know what it is going to be, and I don't know what it'll look like, but I can see it coming, and I can feel it coming.
There's something that has happened in our culture where we've forgotten that there are different ways to approach health. And people are assuming, when I say people, I mean when these government regulations are imposed, they're forgetting that there are different ways to think about how you want to manage your health. So the pharmaceutical approach is one way, but there's a whole vitalistic approach that many people are using all of or parts of to make their best decisions for their families.
And we should have that right.
We should have that right, absolutely. Yeah. And if we don't do anything about protecting that right, it is being taken away from us. Mm. So in the state of Vermont, we have had our philosophical exemption taken away. And there are a lot of people that were surprised after it was taken away, like, what? How could that be possible? They didn't know that they needed to say something, that their lawmakers needed to hear from them about how they felt about this. People were complacent about it. In 2012, in Vermont, we had our first encounter with trying to take the philosophical exemption away. And we talked to our legislators freely about how the reasons why we didn't think that was a good idea. And a lot of people spoke up about it, and they heard, and they didn't pass that. But last year, when the same thing came up, something had changed where it was not okay to be talking about not wanting to vaccinate your child. So there's something that has happened in our culture that has now demonized people for wanting to just take care of their family the way they see fit. Mm. And informed consent has always been part of making any kind of medical decision. And now there's no informed consent if your rights are being taken away on right. Whether you can make that choice or not.
We all need to stand up for freedom of choice in medical interventions, like vaccines. If we don't have that right, then what rights do we really have left?
You have a fundamental right to act in the best interest of your child, raising and rearing your child, being able to choose what school your child goes to, what religion you want to be, and what medical choices. There are some people who choose a holistic path, and there are some families who don't. But whatever that parent feels is best for that child, and that there is no level of immediate risk of harm to that child, that parent, the law says that that parent is to be given deference to their choice of treatment, and that's what's not happening.
Hey, so have you seen personal cases where that preference to the parents has not been upheld?
It's done over and over again. Unfortunately, it's the complete opposite. When Child Protective Services involves, for example, you can have someone to just make an anonymous call and say, hey, I think that child over there, their parent is, they can say anything, is having some whack type of treatment for the child. I don't think it's right. And now Child Protective Services is knocking on your door to investigate how you parent, how you live, and the burden has to shift. It's a burden, a preponderance of evidence that the state has to show, and a compelling state interest. Is there any immediate risk of harm? And what happens is that things just spiral out of control to a point where now the child is being, there's a presumption against the parents before they ever have due process, before they ever walk into court, before they can ever hire a skilled lawyer. You shouldn't have to hire a skilled lawyer to protect a fundamental right and interest when you're being accused, because the burden is not on you, it's on the state. Hey, wait a minute. Families first. That's how it used to be. Families first. Let's go back to how we used to do things.
It's very hard when somebody questions your longstanding beliefs that you've never thought to question. It's like turning your world upside down. And yeah. The thing is that we've got to turn the world upside down to get it back spinning on its axis. Because the problem is our children are suffering, and children's health in the United States is terrible. What is going on? And unfortunately, part of it is because we have too many vaccines too soon. An aggressive vaccine schedule that isn't based on science doesn't help our children. It certainly helps line the pockets of the pharmaceutical industry, and unfortunately, it helps also make doctors make a living. You know, vaccines are the bread and butter of pediatrics. But it's not helping our children's health. And that's the problem. I've interviewed a lot of doctors, and many of them will only speak to me off the record. But what they say is, they say, I was one of the people who said, my way or the highway, you either do things the way that I say or you get out. And they say, I trusted the CDC. I trusted the American Academy of Pediatrics. I didn't bother to go and read the literature myself. And so I thought parents who came in with questions were just plain wrong. Those doctors also had the best interests of their patients in mind. They're kicking parents out of their practice because they're afraid that those patients, those kids won't be healthy if they stay in their practice, right? The best doctors wake up and they realize the CDC is wrong and the AAP is wrong and we've got to change our schedules.
Number one thing, it saved my career, is I had parents come to me and say, Dr. Thomas, have you looked at this article? Have you read about this? Have you thought about that? And physicians who know it all, right, are not interested. So you're probably not going to get through to some physicians who just aren't open to getting any advice or knowledge from somebody who's not a doctor. But I am so grateful to the various patients who came to me and said, well, the very first one was a gal who's an attorney here in town. She had a couple boys who were doing quite well. They were a little quirky, but they were doing okay. And she said, you know, there's this conference coming into town, Defeat Autism Now. This was back in 2002 or 2003. He said, would you just go and let me know what you think? And I had heard about them, and in my world, it was like, oh, those are a bunch of kooks. Do not go to those conferences. They're nonsense. But I went out of curiosity. Why would this attorney be that curious about it? Blew my mind. The level of science in that organization, the articles that were presented, I'd never been to such a scientific conference. And it was like an eye-opener for me, right? And then I'll have patients bring an article and say, you know, have you seen this article? And usually I hadn't. But I would take it, and eventually I would get to it, and it's like, wow. You know, when you start reading things that aren't on your radar because physicians are isolated. We're really a product of a system that has trained us to think a certain way. And when we're in that system, we think it's the best. And we think it's the only right system. And all the rest of you guys out there, you know, whether you're an alternative care provider or you're just a parent, what could you possibly know? Well, a lot. There is so much information out there that, you know, parents, the frustration that parents have is that nobody's listening, right? The media isn't listening. They're not picking up their stories. Their doctors aren't listening. They're not looking into it, right? And so I've been educated by my patients more times than I want to admit it. But because of that, I'm a better doctor, because I've learned things that I wouldn't have learned if I'd stayed with my blinders on.
It's time for doctors to be brave. It's time for doctors to speak up. It's time for doctors to admit their mistakes. I understand it's hard to admit that you were wrong, but we need to follow the example of Dr. Paul Thomas and the other doctors who are starting to speak up, because more and more doctors are speaking out, and we have to do that. There have been so many times in medical history, in recent medical history, when doctors were implicated in making mistakes, and it was the brave ones who came forward who said, we recommended this and we shouldn't have, and we're gonna stop recommending it. And we've gotta do that now with vaccines. And yes, we're in the midst of a sea change because too many children have been damaged by too many toxins, and parents are smart and they're starting to wake up, and it's time to end the damage. It's time to end the autism epidemic. It's time to end the autoimmune disorders. Sick is the new normal in the United States, and that is not acceptable, and no doctor should accept that either.
Well, that's it for tonight's episode. I hope you've learned a lot, and I hope you tune back in tomorrow night. Thanks, and God bless.
I'm Carrie Bundy, and this is Bryce. He was born totally normal. He's happy. He's healthy. And this was his newborn picture. So these were taken the day he came home, 3 days old. And he was very alert, very aware.
How premature was he?
5 weeks.
Wow, 5 weeks.
And he didn't have a NICU stay. He was our only child that did not have a NICU stay, which was shocking because he was the smallest, earliest. So he got his first round of shots at 2 months old. And that round of shots changed him right away. He went from a normal baby. He was our third, so we knew what normal meant. You know, babies are fussy sometimes, but he started screaming 23 hours a day. He had just been hospitalized for RSV. And when we went in, I said, I don't feel comfortable with him being vaccinated because he's just been so sick. I think that we need to wait. And the pediatrician looked at Bryce and I and said, if you don't vaccinate your son, who was born at 35 weeks and is a premature baby, you're signing his death certificate for this whooping cough.
So let's get this clear. The pediatrician said if you don't vaccinate your child...
You're essentially signing his death certificate, which is very ironic.
Are you both there?
Yeah. Because I didn't want to do it, and Bryce was like, we have to do this to keep him safe. I mean, the doctor knew who to target of the two of us.
Because the mom's always questioning everything first, and the dads just kind of go with what everybody else is doing.
So well, I mean, I was more like you. I just went with the medical profession. Right. I just can't get over that. So they cannot get over the pediatrician coming out with that line. If you don't vaccinate him, you'll be signing his death certificate.
Right.
How, that's tragic. Okay, so then what happened?
So he got vaccinated. This was March 1st. And the next few days, he was really calm, which was weird because he'd been screaming for 2 straight months.
They wouldn't make eye contact.
And we have videos of that.
He wouldn't look at you. He wouldn't respond to you.
He just kind of looked at the ceiling, and any time you tried to get in his way, he would just look around you.
So, 2 days of that.
Yeah.
It was three. It was March 4th. He actually had the best day that he'd had in 2 months. He was smiling. He met my mom's best friend that morning. And we have pictures that day of him sitting quietly with Ella, who was 6 at the time, and just learning to read, reading books. And that's the last picture I have, because we went up to our room. And I walked up to kiss him goodnight. It was 12:06 in the morning. And I bent over. It was dark in our room, and we just had a nightlight. And I kissed his cheek, and it was like an ice cube. And I just started screaming to Bryce, he's dead. He's dead. And everything that I know how to do CPR. I'm certified in this. I just stepped back and screamed. And Bryce walked in and just grabbed him and ran. And I'm like, where are you going? As I'm chasing him down the stairs, and he's like, I'm taking him to the doctor at midnight. And he was gone in his Camaro, no car seat, nothing, just had Mason on his lap.
So I grabbed him, I get in the car. I'm trying to do CPR while I'm driving, and it's raining. And I just pulled to the emergency room, and Brandon said that he's dead. And they started working on him, and it was probably about an hour before we got somebody to carry so she could leave our other kids to come to the emergency room to be with me. And there was nothing since they did epinephrine, they gave him all these shots, and his body was just swelling from all the medicine they were trying to give him to get him going again. It was the first time that this hospital had ever had to deal with anything like this. And we had to tell them to stop because he was gone. And they didn't want to stop because they had never experienced that before as a hospital. So Carrie had to be the parents like, he's gone.
When Bryce was at the hospital and I got there, I did not arrive to my husband. I arrived to a man that was crumpled up on the ground, sobbing, not talking to me. We were surrounded by police, separating us, questioning us, would you ever hurt your child? And it's just, I saw Mason and I knew he was dead. I knew he wasn't coming back. And I knew every time I looked at him again that there's nobody in there. That's just his body and there's nothing there. And right now I need my husband. And so he went home and he slept, and I woke up and had to tell my 6-year-old why her brother wasn't here anymore. And we slept on the couch, and when she woke up, I just told her that something happened. We didn't know what happened, and Mason died last night, and he's never going to come back.
Well, then we had to watch our 1-year-old look for him.
Right, because Lucy was 18 months old.
She was looking in the bouncy seat. She didn't understand. She was so little.
And my parents removed the rest of the stuff. Like, my dad, who was with the kids when I finally went to the hospital, he moved everything into Mason's room and shut the door. So, like, the swing, the diapers, everything that was his was no longer there. I didn't want it there. I was like, I don't want to see any of it when I get home. And Lucy was looking for even the swing. She was calling his name. She called him Bubba, trying to say brother. And she's like, Bubba, Bubba, looking everywhere. Oh, and you just cannot tell, you know, a baby that's under 2 years old, like, what happened. So she doesn't remember him, but she knows of him because she's heard us talk about him. This isn't like a stillbirth or a miscarriage, which is equally devastating, but like, we have a year where Thanksgiving, Christmas, holidays, there was a child in these pictures with us that the next year was gone.
There's no words, really, is that? I mean...
No, there's
no. I'm sorry.
And it was the week that he died, it was the day of his funeral that someone said, had he just been vaccinated? And I said, F*** you for even asking that. How could you ask that? You're asking me if I did it? If I caused him to die? And it was. And I think that the reason that there isn't as much said about parents that vaccinate and their child dies is we have this stigma. And we have all of this guilt, because essentially, if we would have known better, this never would have happened and we'd still have a child.
What's your message to parents that people that are just thinking about becoming parents? What would you say to them?
You just have to educate yourself, because you can't rely on somebody else to tell you the information, which is that's what we did, because we didn't know any better. And you just have to have an informed choice.
And with Oliver, who is our son that was born 2 years later, he actually got whooping cough at a year old. So the very vaccine that Mason was given that killed him was preventing the disease that our next son had. And they make you think this child's gonna die, and he was fine. And so it was even harder to see that this disease that I had been so scared of, that I didn't listen to my intuition, was not as scary as I'd been led to believe.
And he's still here today.
Right.
Stronger than ever before.
And he's very healthy.